there is no God but one God, and art is his revealer. That's my creed, and I'll follow it to the end, to a hotter place than Pittsburgh, if need be.
Hello, and welcome to another podcast of Fermat's Last Theater in Madison, Wisconsin. I'm Alex Hancock, and this is the first of several podcasts devoted to the life and work of the great American novelist Willa Cather.
I'm Brett Alpin, and I'll be speaking the words of Willa Cather.
Cather's selected letters, numbering almost 700 pages, were recently published nearly 70 years after her death. Today we're looking at letters and other writings from the first two decades of Cather's life. On December 7, 1873, Willa Siebert Cather is born on a sheep farm in Virginia, the oldest child in a family that will eventually include seven children. When she's nine, the family moves to Nebraska. Many years later, she writes of the enormous upheaval of leaving behind the rolling green hills and woods of northern Virginia for the mostly treeless plains of her new home.
I was sitting on the hay in the bottom of a Studebaker wagon, holding on to the side to steady myself. The roads were mostly faint trails over the bunch grass. The land was open range with almost no fencing. As we drove further and further into the country, I felt a good deal as if we had come to the end of everything. It was a kind of erasure of personality. I would not know how much a child's life is bound up in the woods and hills and meadows around it, if I had not been jerked away from all these and thrown out into the country as bare as a piece of sheet iron. I had heard my father say you had to show grit in a new country, and I would have got on pretty well during that ride if not for the larks. Every now and then one flew up and sang a few splendid notes and dropped down into the grass again. That reminded me of something. I don't know what, but my one purpose in life just then was not to cry. And every time they did it, I thought I should go under. The first thing that interested me after I got to the homestead was a heavy hickory cane with a steel tip, which my grandmother always carried with her when she went to the garden to kill rattlesnakes. She had killed a good many snakes with it, and that seemed to argue that life might not be so flat as it looked there.
So much of Cather's future fiction can be heard in those words. The apparently empty and almost unbearably lonely country, the ambivalent consolation of the larks, and the casual, intriguing strength of a woman who has beaten a good many snakes to death with her cane. After briefly trying to farm this new land, Cather's father moves the family to the town of Red Cloud, where he opens what will prove a not very successful real estate and insurance business. Soon, young Willa begins to befriend many of the town's leading citizens. Even in childhood, most of her friendships are with adults. In the earliest surviving letter, the 14-year-old Willa writes to one of these citizens, Helen Stevens Stowell.
August 31st, 1888. Dear Mrs. Stowell, when I received your letter, I was much pleased, for I had begun to doubt your intention to write. Grandma is much better now, though we do not think she will ever walk again. School begins Monday, and I suppose I shall go, though I don't feel buoyant over the prospect. I have grown so attached to my work and place in the office, and to my little laboratory and dissecting outfit, and my stuffed animals, it is hard for me to leave them. Then here I am, Miss Cather, and govern. There I am a child, and am governed. That makes a great difference with frail humanity. Anson and his wife live where Mrs. Rowe used to live, so you see we are near neighbors. I do not think they are very happy together, but happy is a word few of us realize or are. Nothing he can do seems to please her, and she is cross as two sticks. Winifred and Seward are still happy in the blissful illusion that they love each other. They still amuse the town by their pranks, such as going swimming together, taking endless rides at night in closed hacks, and spending Sunday in the woods. I should think there would be a good deal of ennui in such romance, especially on $1,200 a year. I have been stuffing some birds lately. Hoping to see you all with us ere another Xmas, I remain your affectionate friend, William Cather.
From an early age, Cather often affects a masculine persona. Her earliest letters are usually signed William or even William Cather, M.D. She spends a great deal of time with the two siblings closest to her in age, her brothers Roscoe and Douglas. Among her adult friends are two of the town's doctors. On the last day of the school year that was about to begin in the previous letter, Cather writes again to Mrs. Stowell.
May 31st, 1889. My dear Mrs. Stowell, I suppose that of all the varied emotional phases of human life, there is none so exhilarating as that of triumph, and it is a caprice of fortune that under such I write to you. This day closes the school year, and I am favored with the class honors and bear off the prize for best Latin translations, and consequently, I feel rather cheerful. I am deep in Caesar, in translating the Latin Bible, reading astronomy, geology, history, Homer, Milton, Swinburne, and George Sand. If Anton Rubinstein comes to Omaha, Mrs. Sill will take her best pupils and go up. She has told me her plan. They will purchase the music he will play, and when he to whom the crowned heads of Europe bow in reverence strikes the keyboard, Pythagoras and her disciples will follow him, with a critical eye, nor pass his imperfections by, nodding approval when he does well, and frowning when he blunders. Truly they burn strange fire upon the altar of the gods in these degenerate days. I may go, but not with that intellectual crowd. I shall go as a pilgrim to worship in a far country. How is Georgie's health now? I think I could cure her soon. She must come to see us. She would have a good time, I can promise. When she tires of green peas and chocolate cake and tailor-made young men, she can console herself with my chemicals, stuffed birds, bottled snakes, philosophies, shells, and Latin Bibles. You know, I always thought lots of Georgie, though I seldom care for girly girls. Yours truly, Willa Cather. The spelling and penmanship of this epistle are copyright, all rights reserved, William Cather, Jr.
Part of the joy of reading the teenage Willa's letters is getting to see her terrible spelling. In these first two letters, she manages to misspell buoyant, especially, taking, honors, bear, translating, Rubinstein, Pythagoras, altar, degenerate, tires, chocolate, epistle, even George and Georgie. One person who thinks Willa's writing ability matters more than her spelling is the editor of a Red Cloud newspaper, The Republican, who hires the 15-year-old girl as a reporter.
August 28, 1889. My dear Mrs. Stowell, do you take The Republican? I wish you did, as I am one of the staff reporters and guarantee it to be the newsiest paper printed in town. You know, I have a natural propensity for knowing the business of the town in general. Mr. Harris is very soft on Nellie Wiener. Soft, did I say? Is there no word which means softer than soft? It is positively awful. They will stand in Wiener's store when anyone is in there and hold each other's hands and kiss. Last night I went rushing into their parlor. I never knock, you know. And he lay on the sofa with his head in her lap. She had her cheeks laid against his, her ivory fingers toying with his raven locks, which are rather thin on top of his head. Bah! Some women are like a wet sponge. Just let a man squeeze them and all the sense they ever had runs off. The metaphor is more true than elegant. Yours truly, Willa Cather. P.S. Roscoe and Douglas had a drama in the barn this afternoon. They rendered Robinson Crusoe to a large and appreciative audience.
In the spring of 1890, Willa gives a speech at her high school graduation, as does every one of the other graduates, both of whom are boys. The reporter from the Red Cloud Chief predicts wonderful futures for both of the other speakers and describes himself as greatly surprised by the 16-year-old female speaker's capacity for logical reasoning. Here is the climax of Willa's oration.
Microscopic eyes have followed matter to the molecule and fallen blinded. Imagination has gone a step farther and grasped the atom. There, with a towering height above and yawning death below, even imagination grows sick at soul. For over 6,000 years we have shaken fact and fancy in the dice box together and breathlessly awaited the result. But the dice of God are always loaded, and there are two sides which never fall upward, the Alpha and Omega. Perhaps when we make our final cast with dark old death, we may shape them better.
That fall, Cather enrolls at the Latin School in Lincoln, a prep school for the University of Nebraska, hoping to become a doctor. But when a teacher secretly submits Cather's essay on Thomas Carlyle to the Nebraska State Journal, it is accepted. Years later, she recalls the effect of this publication.
Up to that time, I had planned to study medicine. But what youthful vanity can be unaffected by the sight of itself in print? It had a kind of hypnotic effect. I still vaguely remember that essay. A splendid example of the kind of writing I most dislike. Very florid and full of high-flown figures of speech.
Here is a bit of that florid, high-flown essay.
Carlyle saw the divine in everything. His every act was a form of worship. Yet it was fortunate that he did not enter the ministry. He could never have smiled benignly at the deaconess's tea parties, nor have done the thousand other little things requisite for success. The minister of today should be as shrewd a wire-puller as the politician. Carlyle would have gone to the kirk with the very best intentions, and been suddenly struck with some idea while ascending his pulpit stairs, would have made an eloquent and powerful address upon the doctrines of Buddha, at which his audience would either have gone to sleep or have been shocked, as they happened to feel listless or irritable.
A year later, Willa matriculates at the university. The Nebraska State Journal hires her as a columnist and reviewer, publishing her essay on Hamlet in November of her freshman year. In Lincoln, she also forms her first serious romantic attachment with fellow student Louise Pound. As she's getting ready to leave for home at the end of her freshman year, Cather writes,
1:30 p.m., June 15th, 1892. My dear Louise, I suppose you would object to me saying that you looked very handsome last night? Well, it is true at any rate. I could not help thinking that it was the last time I should see you for some time, and if I had known how queer it would make me feel, I would not have gone up to your house. I suppose you did not feel just as I did, because I was only one of many who was going away, and one gone won't make much a difference with you. I did feel queer. I didn't know it had gotten such a hold on me. I shook myself after I got away, but it didn't alter the facts of the case any. I suppose we will laugh at it all some day as other women do. It makes me feel horribly to think that. It will be worse than if we hate each other. It is manifestly unfair that feminine friendship should be unnatural. I didn't congratulate you because I did not know what to say. I care more for what you will do than what you have done. I want for you in every channel just about the best that life has to give. That's all. Yours, William.
While contributing regularly to the journal, she becomes friends with the daughters of the editor, Charles Gear. Home in Red Cloud after her sophomore year in college, she writes to Mariel Gear after a visit from Louise Pound.
August 1st, 1893. After Louise left, I was lonesome and weary of life, so I went west. Roscoe and I spent several days at my uncle's, who lives in a small colony of Virginians who came out here ages ago, about the time of the creation. We went to one of their meetings, and it was really quite endurable, except a great deal of singing by a young lady who could not sing. You see, the meeting was at the fair damsel's house, so she sang 12 times, not counting encores. All the while that file-like voice grated on, her mother stood in the doorway, gazing on her with fond pride. The 12th song had a refrain beginning, "Pray, does this music charm thy heart?" which, considering the universal disgust, was a somewhat delicate question. The author under discussion that night was Emerson, and I think the Hayseeds understand transcendentalism about as well as most university students, some of them better. By the way, I must tell you about my Aunt Frances sometime. She is one of the ugliest, smartest, and most eccentric of humankind. They say I am like her in ugliness and eccentricity. Give my love to all your folks, and if you meet the certain blonde-haired maiden, gaze on her tenderly for my sake. I am pretty well now, save for sundry bruises received in driving said fair maid over the country with one hand. Sometimes, indeed, with no hand at all. But she did not seem to mind my method of driving, even when we went off banks and over haystacks. And as for me, I drive with one hand all night in my sleep.
During her junior year at Nebraska, Cather has a falling out with Louise, caused in part by a withering portrait of Louise's brother that Cather publishes in the college literary magazine. Home from college the following summer, she writes to Marielle.
We have had a little rain here and are hoping for more. Of course, I want it to rain, but I am rather disappointed in losing such a good crop of suicides as dry weather would certainly have brought. This winter and spring, I sometimes came nearer the verge of desperation than even you knew. The thing I had been living for and in was torn away from me, and it left just an aching emptiness. I don't think the scar will ever heal. If not for you, Mariel, I never could have stuck it out in Lincoln at all. I know I took an awful lot of your time, but I suppose soul-saving is a fairly respectable business, even when the soul is as worthless as mine. How awfully patient you have been all these years. Patient and sympathetic when I raved over her grace, her beauty, her beautiful playing, her beautiful dancing. When I was in rapture because I had accidentally touched her hand, and still patient when the happiness of loving her was lost to me forever. Well, I can't thank you. I can only hope that you will never know such pain to need such a consoler. It is a good thing to love, but it don't pay to love that hard. It makes a fool and dupe of you while you are at it, and then it must end some time, and after it is taken from you, the hunger for it is terrible. Terrible.
After graduating from U of N in June 1895, Cather moves back in with her family in Red Cloud. Feeling as much at a loss over what to do with her life as many another graduate before and since, she continues turning out journalism, short stories, and poems. Early in 1896, she writes to the Gear sisters and two other friends in Lincoln about a New Year's dance she's just been to with her brother Douglas.
Of all roughhouse affairs, of all cakewalks, they had the floor heaped with shavings and chunks of wax, which you had to leap and mount and clamber over with an alpenstock. For seats, they had big rough planks resting on chairs. The boys and girls had the same dressing room. The refreshments consisted of ice water in a wooden pail, coffee and ham sandwiches, which they passed in a potato basket. The men fell down every now and then, and you had to help them up. Yet this was a dance of the elite and bon ton of Red Cloud. I don't know when I will appear in Lincoln next, nor do I care much. One of the charms of the province is that one gets indifferent toward everything, even suicide. Then think of me as one already dead and laid within the bottom of a tomb.
The following spring, Cather is hired by Home Monthly, a magazine for housewives published in Pittsburgh. At a time when few women support themselves, she has become, at 22, managing editor of a national magazine. Shortly before leaving Red Cloud to make her way east, Willow writes to thank Mariel once more.
May 2nd, 1896. Heavens, Mariel, I wonder if I will ever be done making a fool of myself. Lord, but I have always been a monumental idiot, and I don't see how you have stood me at all. For a time I affected the scholastic and quoted Greek at you, and then I affected the bohemian and whatnot. I should get so disgusted with myself that I would just quietly take a dose of prussic acid to rid myself of my own company, if it were not for this one thing. Most of my idiocy has come from liking somebody or other too well.
On arriving in Pittsburgh, Willa boards at the home of the publisher. The Axtells are a family of Presbyterian respectability who live in the well-to-do East End neighborhood.
My dear Mariel, I have only been a few hours in this city of dreadful dirt, so you must not take my first impression seriously. I feel like being funny. The Axtells live in a beautiful part of the city where the hills are built up with big, ivy-grown houses. When we entered the parlor, my heart sank. It is one of the haircloth furniture kind. Its only ornament a huge crayon portrait of Grandpa. Now hear the joyful tidings. Grandpa is not here. He is down at Mission Ridge with Aunt Somebody. They say the climate suits him. May it continue to do so, for I feel that the stern eye of Grandpa, so accustomed to detecting the foibles and follies of this world, would penetrate me thin disguise as the old sage did Lamia's, and he would cry out, I see her, the devotee of French fiction, the consort of musicians and strolling players.
A few days later, she writes to Ellen Gear, Mariel's younger sister.
June 29th, 1896. Well, Nettie, it's not half so bad as I feared. They are not the infant damnation sort of Presbyterians at all. In fact, their church split off from the other church because of its more liberal interpretation of the creed regarding predestination and the summary treatment of infants. Mr. Axtell means to be a jolly man and is an awfully nice one, but fun doesn't come natural to him. Everything is church here. Miss Rush, one of Lydda's 5,700 cousins, was over to dinner yesterday. She's going to Vassar this fall and was talking about the work required at various universities. I told her how many hours I usually carried at the U of N. The dear thing looked up in sweet surprise and said innocently, "How did you ever find time with your church work?" "Oh, Nettie, here every girl has her church work, just as other girls have fans or powder boxes." We went on an organ recital Saturday night. I never heard Schumann's Traumerei on an organ before. The music hall is in the same huge building with the Carnegie Library and Art Gallery. They have all the books in the world there, I think. Right near it is the Casino Theater, and my old friend Pauline Hall plays there all next week. I foresee, alas, that I will not go to the library on matinee afternoons, but will slip across to the casino to look upon Pauline's glorious anatomy once again. The old Nick is in me, Nettie. It's no use talking. As to the magazine, I fear it will be great rot, home and fireside stuff, about babies and mince pies, but the financial outlook is good, so I guess I'll stay by it for a while anyway. Hurriedly, Willa.
Because of a mix-up in the address, a letter from Mariel takes almost a month to reach Willa. In the meantime, she sends a heartfelt plea to Mariel's mother.
My dear Mrs. Gere, why don't some of your heartless daughters write to me? If they only knew how lonely and alone I am, they surely would. I can stand it very well through the day when there is plenty of work and bustle, but at night my soul yearns a good deal for my own kind and for those three beloved girls of yours. From day's end to day's end, I see only the prim old maid who keeps my boarding house and my stenographer. Don't that sound large? My stenographer! You see, the entire responsibility of the first issue devolves on me. We are short of manuscript, and I have written fully one half of the magazine. I was down in the composing room until 1 o'clock last night, sweating over those forms and making up the pages. Then I have all the manuscript reading and purchasing for the September number, and all the correspondence with literary people, which, of course, demands some care. Fortunately, the stenographer is an exceptionally good one and knows how to spell. The responsibility is something awful. I dream about that magazine every night. The magazine is not all I could desire from a literary standpoint. Its policy is rather namby-pamby. But I want to show you all that I can take up a thing and stick to it, even if it don't just suit me. The great key of success is to work when you are not suited, I fancy. You wouldn't know the lazy girl I used to be now. Even the stenographer has been lecturing me about working too hard. My own literary work is a little too heavy for what's wanted in the monthly. Of course, it's a little hard for me to write gentle home and fireside stuff, but I simply will do it. It's so satisfactory to be really of some importance, to have something to do that no one else can do quite as well. It takes all the ennui out of life. As ever yours, Willa.
After the errantly addressed letter from Mariel finally reaches her, Willa writes back with a statement of her artistic creed.
Your letter dated July 10th has just reached me because you forgot to put the sacred words East End on the envelope. This is the Tony part of the town, and the people who are so happy as to dwell here have to be particularized. Now, Mariel, did you ever think I meditated a solid course of Bohemia in all its degrees? Really, I never seriously contemplated becoming a citizen of that desert country by the sea. There is no God but one God, and art is his revealer. That's my creed, and I'll follow it to the end. To a hotter place than Pittsburgh, if need be. It's not an affectation. It's my whole self. Not that I think I can do anything myself, but the worship of it. That is about all that life has given me. It is enough. I don't ask anything more. I think I get as much good out of it as most people do out of their religions. I love it well enough to be a failure in it myself. Well enough to be unhappy. It has felt this way from the time I could like anything, and it only grows stronger as I grow older. I never worked half so hard before. The only form of excitement I indulge in is racing with the electric cars on my bicycle. I may get killed at that, but certainly nothing more. And as to writing, it is not likely that I will treat more delicate subjects than the care of children's teeth for some years to come. I meet so many different kinds of people. I've met a lot of New York dramatic critics, and I have talked 46 minutes with Rudyard Kipling, which alone was worth coming here for. Then my head is so thumping full of new ideas, I seem for some reason to be able to do better work than ever before. In haste and with much love to all, Willa.
Let's leave Willa here for now. 22, living more or less alone in a city that's 1,000 times bigger than any she's lived in before, working tirelessly at a job that would challenge someone a good deal more experienced than she, and with her head thumping full of new ideas. We'll be back with more of the life and work of Willa Cather. Thanks very much to Brett Olpent for bringing Willa's words to life, to our sound engineer Nick Berevic-Hancock, and to Amy Beach for composing the theme music for our Willa Cather series back in 1907. To learn much more about the writer, visit cather.unl.edu.